Here we are in the seminar, the last day of our program, and our topic today is unconditional love and its impact upon my world. Now, Rhonda, would you come over here, please? And just sit down until I call for you.
Yes.
She's part of my, you know, toys. How do I define unconditional love? We talk about unconditional love as being something very special in this world. When you can unconditionally love somebody, magic happens. When you can unconditionally love somebody, every problem in your world disappears. Every problem. When you can unconditionally love something, there's no problem there anymore. Now, I'm going to tell the story, and I'd like Rhonda to play the part of the mother. Unfortunately, her son is at home. I had planned on him being here to be part of the show, but he chose to be with his buddy, and that's good. Okay, Rhonda, you may stand up. Unconditional love is something that we cannot make happen. We cannot make it take place. We cannot make it be an experience in our life. But when it is, wow, what happens is just unbelievable. Rhonda has a son. And the story I'm going to tell you about him is absolutely not true. Okay? Mm-hmm. But Rhonda has a son. And her son is a jerk. He's a good-for-nothing rascal. He is a rotten, rotten, rotten kid. He does not cooperate. He does not put his clothes away. He does not clean up his room. He does not put his guitar away when he's done playing. He does not close off his computer when he's done playing with the computer. He puts his dirty, wet clothes on the floor. In the closet, you think the clothes are hanging from the floor up instead of from the hangers down. And she goes in and she says, please, son, I won't use his name, please, son, hang your clothes up. Please, son, do these things. Then he goes to school, and in school, he feels that that's a place for mischief. And he gives his very best efforts at being mischievous at school. And the teachers at school say, he's incorrigible. You can't teach him anything. He's not going to learn anything. He's a stupid kid. He's a dumb kid. We don't want him in our school. He is just irritating. And if you don't get him shaped up quick, he is going to be off the school list. And Rhonda, she's going to blow her cork. And so she's standing at the door, waiting for her son to come home. He's going to arrive in just moments. And she's ready to throttle him, you know. And then the telephone rings. And the telephone says, hello, are you Rhonda Joyce?
Hello.
Ding! Pick it up. See, this is a cellular phone.
Hello.
Ding! Are you Rhonda Joyce?
Yes, I am.
Miss Joyce?
Yes.
You have just won $30 million on the sweepstakes.
Oh my, really? Wow, yay, I'm rich.
You're not supposed to talk, you're supposed to act. Okay now, yeah, she says, wow, really, I'm rich. But then she hangs up the receiver. She says, thank you.
Thank you.
She hangs up the receiver and she's standing there. Now she's in a daze, you know. She's in a daze. She can't believe that she's just won $30 million. She doesn't even know what $30 million tastes like, much less what they count like or anything else. And so she's standing there, and she's thinking, $30 million? Huh, you know, huh. Not what can I do with it, but, hey, I don't know what I'm doing, I just don't know. And the door opens, and her rascal comes in the door. It's raining outside in Las Vegas, and he throws his wet clothes on the floor, and he comes stomping in the house, and his mother says, son, Come here. Now, you think she's mad. She says, son, come here. So he comes to her, and she takes him in her arms, and she says, I love you. I love you, 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 I love you. Now, do it.
I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you.
Oh, come on, put a little more unconditional love in it.
I love you so much, my little boy. What a good boy you are. So cool.
That's so tough. I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Yeah, she didn't get the script ahead of time. I love you, 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 I love you. Come on now.
I love you, love you, love you, love you, love you.
I thought I'd make room for him in there.
Okay.
And then she says, son, you have wanted a new computer. And you have wanted some new computer games. And you have wanted some special clothing. And this special clothing is something I don't understand, but you want it. So come on, let's jump in the car and go down and buy it. And he says, Mom, you know, he is begeistered. He is flabbergasted. Mom, and she says, now, come on, just leave your wet clothes there. Come on, let's jump in the car and go. And he says, Mom, I don't know what's going on, but I like it. I like it. And so he comes in, and as he comes in, and as they're ready to get in the car, she's thinking to herself, wow, wow, how fantastic. How glorious, you know. And the boy is thinking, Mom, what's come over you? And he doesn't really want to know because he thinks this is just great. So, as he is there, he's going to the store with her. They buy this beautiful new computer for him. Price is no limit, you know. They buy the top of the line. They buy the top of the line with the highest programs in it, with the highest everything in it. They're just really having fun. And you can sit down now, and anywhere you like. And so, as they buy this computer, then they go over and look at the clothing section. And the clothing section has the clothing that this kid just dearly loves. It's way out. It's painted with different colors, and it has all sorts. You know, even his mother hasn't been able to dress as charmingly as that. And they buy this stuff. And then they come home. And when they're home, Rhonda's husband comes up and says, hi, sweetheart. And she says, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. He says, what's going on here? And she doesn't tell him about the money because she hasn't got it yet, you know. She won this $30 million just moments before. And so she doesn't tell anybody because until she's got it in her pocket, she's not going to say anything, you know. But it changed her whole attitude about everything. And she grabbed her husband in her arms and she says, you know, I'm sure glad I married you. You are the neatest guy. And then she lets him go and goes off and fixes dinner. And she makes a nice dinner for them. And then they all sit down to dinner. And she comes in serving the dinner with love in her heart, with joy in her heart, with unconditional love in her heart. Not, you eat this because I made it, you know. But just with love. And everybody sitting at the table is, what's going on here, you know? And so the next week, meanwhile, the husband is just, you know, sky high in his emotions and his attitudes. And he says, what a wife. What happened? You know, what happened? Last week, she was just a normal wife. And this week, wow, she is a lover that is just outstanding, man, fantastic. And the boy, he says, I don't know what's come over Mom, but I like it. I like it, I like it, I like it. So he goes to school. Now, he's got a different attitude too. And in school, he doesn't think that he had been a bad boy. He doesn't think that he did stupid things. That's all completely forgotten. Right now, he is in there for the first time in his life, and he is doing good stuff. He is doing his lessons harmoniously and joyously. He's brilliant. He's fantastic. And as he's so fantastic doing his lessons, naturally, the teacher's esteem of him, I don't know what's come over that boy, but he's a new boy. He's a new boy. He got unconditional love. And what came over this boy? He's a new boy. He's fantastic. He's glorious. He's wonderful. What has come over my son? What has come over my student? What has come over? You know, brand new. Brand new. Because instantly, the past was forgotten. Instantly, she didn't remember it. And they forgot it too, because she infused in them her absolute unconditional love without even realizing she was doing it, you know. She had no idea she was teaching them unconditional love by her living it, but she lived this unconditional love so wonderfully that everyone in her family, everyone in the world did it. Everybody that she knew. She'd call her mother and she'd say, "Mom, how are things going?" And Mom would say, "I'm not sure." "Well, Mom, you are whole and perfect. You're fantastic. I love you. I think you're just the greatest lady in the world. I'm so happy about you. I am so glad to be your daughter. Mom, you are fantastic." And, "Oh, by the way, excuse me, I got the telephone. Bye, Mom." You know, and Mom is sitting there, "What's going on?" See, unconditional love leaves us breathless. Unconditional love leaves us without any remembrance of the past. And mother might have been very upset with you, you know, might have been very upset with her daughter. And her father might have been very upset with his daughter. But when she calls her dad and she says, "Dad, I was thinking about you today, and thank you for being my father. You're great. Bye." Didn't he wait for him to give an answer? "Bye." He's sitting there, "Oh, what happened?" "What took place here? What took place?" But you see, that's the way miracles work. Miracles work without any announcement ahead of time, without any pre-understanding of it. Miracles just take place because you have changed your attitude about your past, and you are now living in your present, and you don't know why. Now, what's $30 million going to do for this lady? Well, you say a lot of good stuff, you know, a lot of interesting things, but what did it do to her? Because she didn't have it right away, she wasn't going to say it. But just the idea that now she is an independently wealthy woman, now she has no limit. She still doesn't have the money, you know, but she has it here. She mentally thinks that she is a wealthy woman. She mentally thinks that she is a new, different woman. She mentally thinks, "There's no problems in my life. My world is wonderful. My son is wonderful. My husband is wonderful. My mom and dad are wonderful. Everybody in my world is wonderful." And Rhonda says, "Gee, her dad would be so nice, but you know, my mom and dad are dead." So what? Call them up. Long distance. "Hi, Mom and Dad. Been thinking about you." "Well, Rhonda, sweetheart, my goodness, it's been a long time." "Yeah, hasn't it? But you know, Mom and Dad, I love you, I love you, I love you." You don't have to have contact. You don't have to have contact. Because she doesn't have that $30 million yet. But she's acting as though she does, and she's living in that consciousness. And she's enjoying all the benefits of living in that positive consciousness now. And she is being unconditionally loving because there is no need to love to get something. She's loving her kid because she loves herself. She's loving her kid because all she knows is love. And she loves him without thinking that he's going to do his homework or he's going to pick up his room. And you know what that kid's done? Because of this unconditional love, not just one day, every day, he put his clothes away in his closet. He hung them on the hangers, you know, and he put them on the hooks. And he began to take special care of his clothing. He began to treat everything with respect and love. And whatever things he had. And then he says, "You know, Mom, I really appreciate this new computer you gave me. I'm enjoying it very much. But can I fix up your computer for you so that it'll be just as nice as mine? Maybe you want to buy yourself a new one and I'll set it up for you and I'll make it just nice for you." And she says, "Phew, how about that?" Never, never, never in his life has he offered to help his mother do anything. Never. Never has he offered to do anything around the house. Never has he offered to do something nice for his mother, even when she needed it. "Sweetheart, you know about computers. Come in here, help me on my computer." "Mom, it's 3 o'clock in the morning." And she said, "Well, that's when I'm working on the computer. Yeah, come on, help me." And now, 3 o'clock in the morning, she says, "Sweetheart, I'm having trouble with my computer. "Oh, Mom, you and your computer, no problem, just a minute." He jumps out of bed and goes in there and looks at her computer and presses a couple little buttons. There you go. You know, kids are undaunted by computers. Kids are undaunted by anything. And when you have them surrounded by your unconditional love, what happens to those kids? Those kids demonstrate to you every good and beautiful thing. Every good and beautiful thing. We were visiting with Anthony last night, and he has two children, Emily and Sage. And they're both neat little kids. What are the ages? 4 and 5 or something like that. And they're running around the house and doing their thing. And we said we wanted to meet their dog. So they brought this little terrier dog in there and jumping all over the place and just as happy as can be. And then they said, "Okay, outside now." And the dog went outside. And the kids came into the kitchen where we were sitting talking while they were cooking. And they wanted to get a little attention. And he said to his son, "Sage, go in and watch your show on TV now." They had a video on a comedy or something. And so they went in there. And then Emily came in and she says, "Mom, how do I do this here?" You know, putting her hair back, and she knew how to do it. But she wanted her mom to give her a little attention. And her mother says, "I bet you can do it better than I could ever do it. Show me how you can do it yourself." And the kid went in the other room and did it really neat. It was a mess, but she did it really neat. And her mother said, "Wow, you're getting that down pat. You're doing so nice on that." But you see, and then we continue with our conversation. We continue with our discussion. And we had a nice, quiet talk. And then I was watching his wife. And as I watched his wife was like this here. She looked at him with such adoration, with such delight, with such peace. It made me think, wow, if all marriages could have that delight in them, that peace in them, that feeling of caringness, not ownership or anything. She's a marvelous being. And he surprised the living daylights out of me. Because he spoke to his children, and his children instantly did what he asked, and he spoke in a gentle, quiet tone to them, and they responded to him. Now, I was of the impression that the children were kind of cut-ups and that he and his wife were not necessarily the happiest of people, but they put on a good show for us. And I think the show was real. I think the show was real. You see, why do I think this? Because I went into his home expecting peace and love and harmony and right action, and that's all I found. I went into Ellie's office today, and when I went into her office, I thought to myself, man, she could do so much good work in here if she didn't have so many distractions. And you know what the biggest distraction she has in her office? What do you think it is, Ken?
Couch.
The couch. The biggest distraction in her office is this lovely couch, because it's so "Come and rest on me. You're working too hard. Come and rest on me. Come and take a nap on me." And you know, it invades her entire office. She has some nice chairs, nice other equipment, desk and what have you. But that couch is just overwhelming. And come, and you don't have to do this. And what Allie can be doing, she can be thinking, "I am a genius. I know all the techniques to develop this business that I have into a successful, wonderful business. Now, I am going to wrap this business with my unconditional love and see it as an absolute success. I'm not going to see people pouring in here. I'm not going to see money pouring in here. This business is a success. Because the people, the money, and all those things, they're already there. She is independently wealthy. And now all she wants to do is see the business a success. And to her, the business is a success if she has people coming in to talk to her and she works with them on whatever their problems may be and finds a solution for them. And when she does this, she's not lying on the couch. When she does this, she's not sitting in her comfortable chairs that you can't get out of. You know how some of these soft chairs are, you're sitting down on the floor almost, you know. And fortunately, Ken was there to pull me out. But you want to have your office be an office. You know, in successful offices, and maybe all of you know this already, but in successful offices, the offices are designed with very fine furniture, but the furniture upon which the clients or guests sit are furniture that are tilted forward just a little bit on the seat, so that you keep sliding out of the chair. And you cannot stay in that chair too long. You have to do your business and get out, because you're on the floor otherwise. You keep, and this is not a joke. This is true. And the more comfortable the chair, the more they're going to take your time after you have already given them the information that they came in for, after you've already given them the treatment that they want to know about their divine self, and then they just want to banter back and forth. Small talk. I tell people, I have no time for small talk. I have no time for small talk because I am only here for the purpose of doing whatever you want me to do. You come in here and you say, I have a problem. And I say to you, all right, you have a problem. What is your problem? And then they say, well, my problem is, I misspoke. What is your solution? See, I want to give them time to mentally have the problem run through their mind. What is your solution? What solution would you like that would take care of your life relative to your problem? And they say, well, I've got to tell you my problem first so you can help me on the solution, because you can't help me on the solution unless you know the problem. And I said, oh, yes, I can. But if you tell me the problem, I'm going to have to spend time cleaning the problem out of my consciousness, seeing it not valid, and seeing the solution valid for you. No. You have a broken leg. And I say, wonderful. How about two of them? You know, if you like that broken leg that you're telling me about, we can make two of them, you know. Well, you stupid person, what are you trying to say? Two broken legs. Well, no. Do you want the leg to be whole and perfect? Of course. Well, then say it. My leg is whole and perfect. My leg is whole and perfect. My leg is whole and perfect. Say it. And people go to the doctor, and the doctor says, okay, money coming in, medicine, pills, and all these things. And that's good. But the doctor does his job. But now if you go to the doctor and you say, doctor, I am whole and perfect. I have this leg that needs a little attention, but I'm whole and perfect. The doctor says, hey, that's a good start, you know. And he touches up the leg, puts a cast on it, or whatever is necessary. And then he says, now, you ask the question. You say, how long will it take to heal? And the doctor, who is a metaphysician, who is a wise man, he says, what is your attitude about it? Is it a bother to you to have a broken leg? Or is the leg already whole and perfect in your mind? Are you going around with thoughts in your mind that the leg is already healed, that the leg is whole and perfect? Or are you going around with the idea, I got a broken leg. Hey, I got a broken leg. Hey, I got a broken leg. Tell them, no. You go around as though it's not there. You walk around with the cast on and do your things, but you wouldn't know you had a broken leg. One of our students in Europe, their son broke his leg playing soccer. And so they put a cast on his leg. And then what was he doing next? He's out there playing soccer again. He said, boy, oh boy, this leg gives me a lot more power. When I kick that ball, it goes flying, really flying. And hey, he's not supposed to do that. He's supposed to take it easy. Well, the leg is healing inside of that cast and doing perfectly well, healing inside of his mind. And he has that cast off his leg within days where other people have it in within weeks. Because in his mind, that leg is all whole and perfect. In his mind, that leg has never been hurt. And you see, you say, well, the fact is it was broken. Yes, the fact is it was broken. But was it broken in his mind? His mother, her son was a rascal, and he was a naughty little boy, and doing very bad things in school and everywhere else. And it was enough to drive the mother mad. But then all of a sudden, the mother lost her consciousness. She lost her remembrance of how bad her son was. She lost her thought that anything was wrong. She lost all that stuff. And you see, in losing that stuff, what happened? What happened when she lost all that stuff? It had no more power. It had no more existence in her life. She now was whole and perfect. She now was healed of the thought that her son was a naughty boy. And so she treated her son like a wonderful boy. She treated him like a fabulous boy, like her beloved son. And the son acted like a beloved son. He acted like a whole and perfect. Her mother no longer held over his head the problem that he'd had before. And so he moved right into this new self, this new beingness that he is. And you see, this is what we want to learn to do. We want to learn to unconditionally love ourselves, unconditionally love our world, unconditionally love every circumstance that goes on in our life. And the only way we can do it is by practicing unconditional love. Now, how do you practice unconditional love? How do you define unconditional love? How do you even think about it in the first place? Well, you think about unconditional love very easily. You just release any thought about any problem in your life. You release any thought about any condition in your life. We have one of our students in Africa. He is doing very well. His name is O.K. Akabakabakabuchiti Abadudi. You know, real nice long name. And so he wrote his thesis, and in his thesis he said he had to go to the court because the neighbor was complaining about his business and how much noise it was making and so forth. So he went down to the court and he signed in, and when he signed in, he told the clerk, he said, well, this will be a dismissed case right away. There's no problem at all. And the clerk put him on the docket. And then the day of his court case came along. And before he went down to court, one of his neighbors started talking to him about the different things. And then all of a sudden he remembered that he had this court case, and he was kind of nervous about it. And he says, all is in divine order. All is in divine order. So then he went down to the court. And as he walked in the court, here was a man, the clerk, and another woman, and a woman sitting there. And the man says, well, Reverend O.K., how nice to see you. And he says, fine. And he said, what about this case that I have today? And the clerk says, that's been moved back for a while. Now, if you want it today, the judge will come in, but the judge hasn't had her bath yet today, and she's got a headache and not feeling too well. You want to have it today, or you want to have it later? And he says, later, of course. Yeah. Well, eventually, the case turned out that the opponent, who had an objection to him and his business, didn't show up, and so the court case was dismissed. But he put in his mind that all was in divine order. He went down there, all was in divine order. He believed that all was in divine order. He virtually changed the circumstances from the appearances that were very obviously there to a fact that it was unimportant and it had no bearing upon him whatsoever. You see, he was learning unconditional love. I might add, he has two wives, and he has 14 children, and he is an exquisite father, most amazing man, and he's not an Islam, but the government of Ghana allows you to have as many wives as you like, you know, which is interesting. And so he has these two wives, and the two wives are absolutely gorgeous, and the two wives brought their children in for services and for the program, and it was just wonderful how he conducted this program with him. He showed how he lived unconditional love with his family, with his friends, and with everyone in his world. And he also wrote in his thesis that his mother was ill, and that he spoke his word that she was okay. And she was about 89 or something like that. And so he went home and found out she was okay. And he said, "You're doing just fine. I see you just fine." And then he went home later and found out that she was not doing fine. And he went over and talked to her and told her he loved her. And she had that sort of, this is the end experience in her mind, you know, in her heart. And so he just released her. And she had a peaceful passing, knowing that her number one son had released her and allowed her to move on to her next dimension of life. Now you see, when you're learning unconditional love, it works for you in so many areas when you let it work for you in so many areas. You work with this unconditional love in so many areas so that it's your fullness of your life. It's the fullness of everything you do and everywhere you go. You know yourselves, at least I do, that when you use unconditional love on pets, it's fantastic. I have a golden retriever that's, you know, like so high, and a big young fellow of a year and a month, and just a lover, pure lover. And I'm teaching him as we walk the mile and a half or 2 mile path around the campus, and I'm saying, "Rex, come here," and I give him a cookie, you know, or "Rex, go there," and I give him, you know, a doggy treat or something. And then I don't want to give all the doggy treats away because it's like giving him another meal. So I say, "Rex, sit." And he sits, you know, ready for a treat. And so I reach down and I put my arms around his chest and his back and I snuggle him and say, "I love you, I love you, I love you, you're so wonderful." And he looks up at me and says, "No treat." But he knows that that hug is the treat. He knows that that is. And I would rather like to think that he likes the hug better than the treat, because he makes out on treats pretty well too. I'm sitting on my bed, putting my shoes on, getting ready to take him for a walk or something, and he jumps on the bed behind me, and he puts his head on my shoulder over on this side. He says, "How soon?" On this side, "Come on, hurry up, put the shoes on." And, you know, just sort of encouraging me to go along. Unconditional love. Now, he is unconditional love because I am unconditional love. That's all I know, and that's all he knows, is unconditional love. And he does everything I ask him to do. Sometimes he plays games. He's a youngster yet, but he's learning, and he's learning very well. Now, what about you? How do you treat your pets? How do you treat your wife or your husband? How do you treat your friends? These are all our pets. How do we treat the people in our life that we love dearly? I mean, I love Rex, you know, just unimaginably, because he's so super, so wonderful. But how do you treat the people, the pets, the things in your life that you love with unconditional love? You have to be careful. You have to be careful. Because one of the things that is so important on our spiritual path, to understanding our divinity, to understanding who we are, is we must walk the path alone. You cannot walk the path with anybody else. You are the only person who is inside of you. And so when you do your meditation, when you do your introspection, why is it they don't recommend that you bring dogs and cats in church? Why don't they recommend that you bring the dogs and cats into the temple? They have special times that you bring them in for blessings and so forth, but they don't bring them in. Because a dog and a cat is a distraction. And any distractions we have in our life keep us from understanding who and what we are. You see, a pet is a distraction. And when we go into our meditation time, into our quiet time, into the time of listening to the divinity within us, and we have a goldfish in the room. A goldfish in the room. Yeah, a goldfish in the room. Ellen has a fish on her desk. A little jar, you know, with a single fish in it. And the fish has been there for months, you know, happily living by itself. And if that fish is in Ellen's meditation room, she is aware of its consciousness. The consciousness of a fish. That's right. The consciousness of a fish. If you talk to an Indian, I don't know if you ever know any Indians or believe any Indians, I mean, they're kind of silly, but the Indians say, the stones talk to them. The stones talk to the Indians. The stones tell the Indians how to go about living a beautiful and complete life. Jesus said that too. He said, if someone were to do something evil, the stones would speak out and tell the story, right? Now, what do the Indians say about the stone? The stone is a symbol representing life, representing healing, representing wholeness, representing peace, representing all these things. I was talking to a fellow last night about this too, and I said, he gave me something representing a black bird, a big black bird, you know, a raven. And I said, oh, on the telephone pole just outside of our dining room window are two large ravens that sit there every day. And our dogs love to look up at them and bark, you know, and say, come on down, play. And so they just drop on them. And so I told this fellow that the raven feathers are everywhere. He said, send them to me. I'll trade you for something else, but send them. And hey, I'll send them to you. I'll send them to you. We have the feathers of hawks and the feathers of eagles and the feathers of all these wonderful flying creatures on our ranch. We have 104 acres in Southern California on the Mexican border almost. And so we're very primitive and very quiet and very peaceful, beautiful rocks in which the eagles live. And it's a glorious place. And of course, they're always coming and saying, Herb, that's me, Herb. Herb, you are the superest guy in the world. Aren't they wonderful? They're so perceptive. Herb, you are the greatest guy in the world. May I give you a gift? And so they drop a feather down on me. And I take that feather and I say, cool, you know. And I'm walking along the meditation path. And as I walk along the meditation path, I'm sitting on the meditation bench. And here I see the ruffles of a few eagle feathers, the soft ones, the under feathers, lying right next to the bench by me. And wherever I go, I see this peace. And other people walk along and they see rattlesnakes. And I never see rattlesnakes. Not because I don't like rattlesnakes, but I let a rattlesnake be. When a rattlesnake comes into my life, I say, hey, you know the rule here on campus. You got millions of acres out there to play on. You go out there and play on. You disturb people here, and I don't want you to be hurt because, you know, you're a neat guy. And so he wiggles away and shakes his tail at me and says, thanks, Herb. You know, always doing beautiful things. But this is love, unconditional love. And does it always work out beautiful like that? Oh, yes. I had six coyotes come walking across the path one morning. And Rex and I were out for a walk, and I saw them down there, and I let them walk far away, you know, across the path and away so that Rex wouldn't go down and try to go playing games with them, you know. And so then we came down the path, and when we came to the point where they had walked across the road, Rex smelled that. And he says, oh boy, something to play with. And he dashed after the guys, and they were long, long gone. But he caught up with one of them. And one of them said, hey, you're kind of big, you know, you're a big guy, and we're just little guys. And Rex says, come on, let's play. And so he said, no, you don't understand. We don't play with animals, we eat them. you are our breakfast and our lunch and our dinner and stuff like that. And so this coyote was alone. The others had walked ahead, and Rex still wanted to play with him. So the coyote says, must I teach you a lesson? And so he bit him on the hind leg here, inside and out. And it didn't hurt him terribly, but, you know, it's a coyote that eats everything and has all sorts of tastes in his mouth. And so we took him to the vet and had him treated. But the coyote was saying, let us alone. But you see, we, in our friendliness, in our humanness, and the dog is like us too. He wants to be friendly and human to everybody. He wants to love everybody and everything. And we have to teach them. They have a right to their life. Don't fool around with them. Bless them and release them. Let them go their way. So this is what happens to us. We must learn to bless and release in our life. We have thoughts that come into our mind that are sometimes not beneficial to us. We have thoughts that come into our mind that tell us that we are not good people. You think I believe that about myself? Huh? No way. A thought that comes in my mind that says I'm not a good person because I did something silly, I'll say, that's not a desirable thing that I did. It's silly, and I don't choose to do it again. But, hey, I'm not going to kick myself around the block 10,000 times because I did it. I'm going to release it and not do it again and be myself. Do good stuff. Do good things, you know? How many times have you done something silly when you shouldn't have done it, you know? How many times have you looked at the bark of the tree and you saw the bark of the tree was loose? And so you reach over there and you pull the bark, the loose bark off so the tree will look nice, you know, get all that flaky bark off the tree. Well, that flaky bark had to come off of that tree by itself. It's like a scab. You don't pull the scab off. These are remarks from my beloved Rex saying he loves me with his paws. The bark of the tree is on the tree as part of its dress and part of its skin. And when it falls off naturally, that's beautiful. But when you pull it off, then you make that open area susceptible to worms and diseases that might come in. Let the nature do its thing. We always want to help Mother Nature along. And I did that foolishly. And after I did it, I ran my hands up and down the tree there to clean off the old bark and make it all beautiful and good. And then all of a sudden, the tree says, I wasn't ready to come out yet. And it died. Now, it was not dying when I was taking the bark off, but it died when I took the bark off and took away its protective outer coating while it was healing itself, while it was coming awake. You see, that's a stupid thing to do, and I should certainly know better, and I should not do that. But I'm not going to kick myself around the block for doing it. I'm going to say, okay, I will not do that. I have thousands of other trees on our property, and these trees each have their way of living and being, and I'm going to respect that. I'm going to respect that in the naturalness of the way that they're living, and I'm not going to tell myself I'm stupid for doing it. But I'm going to respect it. Now, we have thoughts that come into our mind that tell us that we are not nice people. We have thoughts that come into our mind that say that we are sick or we are poor or we are limited in any way. And it's up to us to be the master of our thoughts. Now, you go to school and you take a course and you say 2 times 2 is 4, 2 times 2 is 4, 2 times 2 is 4, 2 times 2 is 4. And then you say to the teacher, I'll never learn that. I'll never learn that 2 times 2 is 4 and 2 times 4 is 8. I'll never learn that. And the teacher says to you, come, let's do something different. And so the teacher gives you 2 blocks and says, now, what if you had that twice? Like, you know, 2 times those 2 blocks. He says, well, what do you mean? Okay, now let's take 2 blocks here. And what would happen if you had another 2 blocks? Well, you'd have 4 blocks. Well, 2 times 2 is 4. Oh. And then you work gently in whatever you are guided to work with in teaching children so that they get the idea that they know that. Yes, I was so stupid not to recognize it. That's so easy, that's so right, so good. And next thing you know, everything is easy for the person, because they have learned that learning is not a difficult task. Learning is a happy task. Learning is an experience where your heart says, yes, 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 I know. Because learning is revealing that you already know the answer. Because you say when you know the answer, yes. You don't say when you know the answer, no. You say yes. Because you are revealing to yourself that you already know it. Now, this is the fantastic thing about being a master of yourself. We are told it is done unto us according to our belief. It is done unto us according to our belief. These are psychological treatments. These are physiological treatments. These are treatments philosophically, mathematically, religiously, from every possible course. It is done unto you according to your belief. What is our belief about ourselves? Do we believe that we have within us the omniscience, all-knowingness of the universe? The omnipotence, the all-power of the universe? The omnipresence, the everywhere presence of the universe? If any of you read Richard Bach's Jonathan Livingston Seagull book, very wonderful book, so thick, 40 minutes long, if you've ever read it, you read in there where he said to the seagulls, perfect speed is being there. Perfect speed is being there. Now that is absolutely idiotic, absolutely unstable, absolutely unrealistic. And so the scientists today have picked up on that, you know. And the scientists today report in all of their scientific journals, Discovery Magazine, in Popular Science, in Scientific American, and on and on. And in their journals, they report, all time is now, and all space is here. It's a concept that's very difficult to believe in, you know, that we're all right here together in one little tiny little atom, so to speak, that all is here now. And that's what they're telling us. Now what they're saying is, if you have a near-death experience, in the near-death experience, your whole life flashes before your mind in just an instant, your whole life, and you can understand it. You can understand each little phase of your life as it's going through your mind in an instant like that. And that is slow. That is slow according to reality. Because all matter, all time, all space exists right here and right now. And the sooner we come to realize that, which we don't need to know, but it's interesting because then we can start being there now, you're there. Now, Ellen has a mother in Germany, and her mother is a lovely lady. And I said to Ellen, Ellen, what's your mother doing right now? And Ellen says, playing the piano. I said, how do you know that? She says, because I know. Within me, I know. And I say, Ellen, whenever you ask yourself a question or think of anything, know that you know that you know, and you will know that. Speak that consciousness, speak that concept right within yourself, and it'll be revealed to you. And then Ellen says, you know my mother's passed on. I said, sure. That doesn't make any difference. Because the dimensions of time and space, which are universal, we each live in a billion dimensions of time and space right now, and a billion is too small. Because we live in an infinite number of times, but we haven't the capacity in our human thinking to consider it. Consider, Bill Gates is worth so many billions of dollars. That's cool, okay? You say to Bill Gates, how much money do you have? He says, I don't know. He says, I don't care. He says, I got lots. Okay, Bill, what about taking $1 billion and counting it? He says, no. If I take $1 billion and count it, then I will have nothing, I will not be able to do all the other things I want to do. The money is there, not because I want it, not because I need it, because I am it. He said, my dream is to do software, to draw software, to write software, to create software. And I do my dream. And by the way, the billions are piling up in the bank, you know? That's a neat idea. But that's not his thought. That's not, it never was. The billions just piled up. Every person who has ever worked with Bill Gates from the beginning in Microsoft has become a multi-millionaire. And beautifully so. And each one is going off doing their thing. Why are they so wealthy? Because they're doing what they want to do. They're letting their heart come through and express itself in the magic that they would like to know for themselves. And you and I, we can do this too. We can do this too. I am not demonstrating billions right now, but wherever I go, I have a very lovely home to live in. Whatever country I'm in, and I'm in all countries all over the world giving lectures and seminars, I have a very lovely place to go. They feed me, they house me, they take care of me, they buy me gifts of clothing and stuff because they think I need better clothing and whatever, but I'm not bothered by that. And they tell me, you know, all sorts of good things, but they love me. They want me to come there because I tell them the truth about themselves. I tell them that they're wonderful people. They're beautiful people. I go to Africa and I talk to these third world people who have nothing. And I say, you have everything. You have everything. Your country, Nigeria, is lying on a bed of oil, the eighth largest oil reserve in the world. If you were to capitalize on that oil reserve, your country would be so wealthy that everybody would be like you. In your country, everybody would be driving around in great big cars and have beautiful big houses and not have to work if you don't want to and have perfect health insurance and have perfect educational schools for you. Fantastic! And I tell that to these people. And I'm speaking usually to the children from the elementary schools and the high schools and the colleges. And as I speak to these people, I say to them, you are great, and your legislators of this country are doing everything they can to build this country, to bring hospitals, to bring streets, to bring roads, to bring utilities, to bring water, 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 beautiful fresh water to everybody in abundance. It's there. And so these children, they go home. And because they're in school, their parents have enough money to send them there, and their parents are the legislators, their parents are the leaders of their country. They go home and tell this to their parents, and their parents say, oh, yeah, okay, better schools, better, you know. And then we go on television, we go on the radio in these countries, and we sing them their new national anthem. We sing the new national anthem to the country, you know that? And they are delighted. And the teachers write it down, and the students sing it. They sing it on the way home, and they sing it to school, and they sing it in churches, and they sing it everywhere. And do you know what that new national anthem is? Ellen, will you sing it for us? This is now for Nigeria.
Attention title and guide from the light with the light,
the night with the light from within,
from the mountain to the valley, from
to the ocean white with foam. I bless Nigeria, my home sweet home. I bless Nigeria, my home sweet home. Now you recognize the tune. But I gave it to Nigeria. I gave it to Ghana. I gave it to Guyana. I gave it wherever I went. I gave it to Switzerland. Can you imagine that? Switzerland? But you see, Switzerland wants to shape up too. Switzerland is just not all that is so pretty like you think it is. It has some areas to straighten out, you know that? Then it has some areas to straighten out. And the United States has some areas to straighten out. And so when people start saying, I bless, let's see, I bless America, land that I love. I stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from within. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam, I bless America, my home sweet home. I bless America, my home sweet home. Now, in every country where this is sung, it changes the people. It changes their attitudes about themselves. It changes their way of thinking, and they start thinking that they've got a great country. Instead of, like in Nigeria, they were thinking they have a government that is crooked and what corrupt government, you know. And that's so stupid. They even put it in the almanac that the government in Nigeria is corrupt. And I told them, I said, you know, you people are very silly. I would sue the almanac. I'd say, take that out of there. That's an opinion that it's a corrupt government. By what are you basing your facts that that's a corrupt government here in Nigeria? Nigeria has the best government in the world. Nigeria has a government of the people, for the people, by the people. You've heard that before. Nigeria has a government of the people that are for the people, that want to give us hospitals, that want to give us roads, that want to give us schools, that want to bring water to the people. Nigeria is great. Ghana is great. And so then we continue our story, and we go there year after year, and instead of chasing us out of the country, the government invites us with open arms. And then my neighbor, who fixed our swimming pool for us, we had a swimming pool and jacuzzi and stuff like that, and you know, what do you put, chlorine in it and things like that, and that's not pleasant to swim in that stuff. And so he has a device that makes ozone, and so he sold us an ozone device for a couple hundred dollars, and that ozone device completely purifies the water of the pool. Completely. You can drink the water if you wish. And it completely purifies the water of our jacuzzi, our swimex, and our swimming pool outside and everything, and it's wonderful. And so we told the government in Nigeria about it, and Ghana. And they are very interested in it. And our neighbor says, sure, $200 for a little box like this, and you can have pure water for 18 houses, 18 families, for 38 cents a year in electrical costs. Almost nothing, you know? Because it's just an activation through the water. It's beautiful. Now, we go around telling the world this, and I was telling one of my students in Switzerland, and I said, Edith, this is what our program is. And she says, I work for the government in Switzerland. And she says, we do things for third world nations that need help, and I'm going to recommend that we do this ozone program for them. I said, my gosh, you've got ozone going in your own country already. You have big ozone companies that are producing it and giving out that special water for your people. And she said, I didn't know about that. And I said, well, ask me. I know everything. I don't live there. I just visit. But I open my eyes. I listen. I was living in Romanshorn for a while, and this is on the Lake of Constance, and as I was living there, next two doors away from my house was a great big beautiful building, and I kept asking what that is. Well, it's an ozone factory. It makes, from the old-fashioned way, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, they take ozone and purify the water for the people who live around the lake. And it works beautifully. And they use it in other places in Switzerland. I said, help these third world countries with this beautiful water purification stuff. And you see, when you open your eyes, you can be a blessing, not by helping people, but by bringing to their attention that they help themselves. Now, these people now want to have that for themselves. Other students that we have in Nigeria, the Agabawas, who are been with us for years and doing beautiful work, they want to do it too. He was a chemical engineer with biochemical substances that he used, and he has his doctorate and all that stuff. And so he is interested in this. And so I'm gathering together all this stuff. Now, who pays me for doing that? Who pays me for doing that? My heart. Who pays me for doing all these things that I do, going around the world, talking to them, and caring about the people of the world by giving them the positive attitudes of mind that lift up their hearts and give them a new direction to life? Me. I pay myself. Who provides my income? Me. And it's always there. Our students, they attend our seminars. We have our Montebrei seminars in Switzerland, Locarno, Switzerland. And it's a week-long School of the Master seminar. And after the seminar is over, and they have paid their full fee for the seminar, which is quite expensive, they say, "Herb, that seminar was super. That changed my mind. So one big industrial executive over there gave us a check for $10,000. And he does this every year, giving us these additional funds and checks to make our work all the more easy. And it is fantastic. It is glorious. It is wonderful to see how these things work. But when you openly give of your heart without expecting anything in return, the doors of the infinite universe open before you to give you the opportunity to be of service, to be loving, to be generous. We go many places. Europe is good. Europe provides a lot of funds for our activities, and that's good. America, it's not really too beneficial to us yet, although we have done quite well. One lady came up to us the other day, and she says, "I like what you're doing." I said, "Well, thank you." She says, "I have a church I'm not using. I'd like to give you the church." I said, "Well, thank you very much." And so it was a church name and a corporation, nonprofit corporation in California and the world. And so I said, "Thank you very much." And so she gave it to me. She said, "Well, here's the banking account for the church, too." And I said, "Okay, $5,000 or something, you know." And so we looked at the bank account, $257,000, you know. Now, that was kind of nice. That gave us an opportunity to do a lot of beautiful things. And this is how you can have it. When you give, I'm not trying to say I'm so good, but when you give, I am so good, but when you give, and you give totally of yourself, and you give without expecting anything back, you give out of the love of your heart, which pays you the reward that you find unbelievable. When you give out of the love of your heart, it comes back to you in overflowing measure. You see, I don't want your money. I'd like to have anything you want to give me, of course, but I don't want your money. I want you to have your money. I want you to have your independent abundance, your independent wealth, which belongs to each one of you and which is right here, and you haven't even, with unconditional love, opened up the bag or the suitcase or whatever you got it in, you know. You haven't even opened it up. Now, Bill Gates, you say, "Oh yeah, he's so wealthy." Well, Bill Gates didn't start out that way. Bill Gates loves hamburgers and hot dogs. Now, where did he get a taste for hamburgers and hot dogs? As he was developing his program, that's the kind of money he had, hamburger and hot dog money, you know. And so that's what he ate, and that's what he loves, even to this day, even though he's the richest man in the world. Now, he just worked on what made him happy. He did what made him happy, and the abundance came to him. Now, don't tell me, but I'm going to ask you to tell yourself. Does the job you're doing, does the work you're doing, is the field and endeavor in which you have applied your life, has it made you happy? Has it made you wealthy? Has it made you very, very rich? Or has it sometimes even made you sick? You know, has it made you feel very sad? Has everything that you have done in your life brought dividends of joy and peace and harmony into your mind and your experience? Then you know you're doing the right thing. If it hasn't brought that into your life, you can be sure you're not doing the right thing. So, how can we find out what the right thing for us is to do? Well, that's very simple. What do you do to find that out? Let's see what it is. Oh, yes. Being one-pointed, being untouched, being non-possessed, being non-judgmental, and living with no past. Isn't that wonderful? How can you be, now, the mother who got the $30 million and was so surprised she forgot all about her son being such a bad boy, how can you have that feeling that the mother had of winning the $30 million and just forgetting the past, forgetting all the past? How can you have that experience in your life? Now, the Bible and teachings of many nations and cultures and churches and organizations, they teach you to forgive. Right? You hear a lot about forgiveness. And even the Dalai Lama teaches about forgiveness. But what is forgiveness? Forgiveness is forgettingness of anything that was non-beneficial to you. You forget that you ever were doing stupid things. And I'm going to tell you how easy that is, and you don't think it is, but this is how easy it is. In the 1970s, 60s and 70s, we had a bunch of kids running around this nation, this world, who were absolutely without redemption. They were terrible. Drugs and this and that and everything. And they were terrible, 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 terrible. And today, they are running our government. They are the mothers and fathers of the children of today. They are wonderful, beautiful, sensitive, caring, responsible, wonderful beings. You know that? And at the time, the older people, the elders you might say, looked at the children, looked at the young people, even in their 20s and their 30s, doing these terrible things, and thinking, surely, what's going to happen to our world when they take over? You know? And they will, because they're the next generation down. What's going to happen? And what happened was the natural goodness within them came forth, and that natural goodness that they are, the divine goodness that they are, is what they are using to run the government and the world today. Now, that's good. But even better is if we can start teaching ourselves and our world the ability to forget the past and live in the present. To forget the past and live in the present. People come to me for spiritual healing often, and they say, what can I do? I've got this terrible problem. I've got this terrible problem. And I tell them, whatever you want, we'll work on. But I got this terrible problem. Whatever you want. And I go on and on and on, because I'm not, I'm indefatigable. You cannot tire me. And so I go on and on. And then finally they say, oh, you want me to tell you what I'd like to experience? Yes. Now, what would you like to experience? I would like to experience wholeness. I would like to experience abundance. I would like to experience happy family relationships. I would like to experience peace on earth. I would like to experience, oh, ho, ho. Whatever you would like to experience, you come back to that phrase again, it is done unto us according to our belief. So, what are we thinking about? What are we believing? What cause are we putting in motion? We have a song. Is there a joy song book there? We have a song, and it's called Peace on Earth. You've all heard it. But we rewrote the words just a little bit. And instead of having the words say that, I asked for one book. Instead of having the words say that, let there be peace on earth, the words say in our book, now there is peace on earth, and it began with me, with my thought. It's done unto me according to my thought. Now there is peace on earth, the peace that is meant to be. I am God the Creator, oneness all my world, walking with my creation in perfect harmony. Now there is peace in all, for this is the moment now. With every step I take, I offer my solemn vow to take each moment and live each moment in peace eternally. Now there is peace on earth, for it began with me. You see, it began with my thought. Now there is peace on earth. It began with me. It began with my thought. I put the thought in motion, and that thought brought the peace into my world. Now, I will dwell upon this thought for a few moments and blow your minds. Most people are irresponsible. They say, I didn't do it, they did it. They don't realize that they're the cause of every experience that takes place in their life. Nothing happens by accident. There are no chance things that take place in our life. Everything happens by a cause, being it is done unto you according to your belief. There is nothing that takes place without a cause being given to it. Now, people want to forget the fact that according to the Bible, at least, we're told that God created all things and called them good and very good in the beginning. Now, every religion, every philosophy, every country, everybody in the world believes there is something that caused everything to start, everything to have its beginning. And they think it might be their daddy or their mommy. They think it might be some big kahuna in the sky, some God, some spirit consciousness, some essence that's so wonderful. And then, when they stop and analyze it, they come to the realization that whatever created all, it gave all its essence. So whatever is created has the essence of its creator in it. So if, using the word God, if God created all things, then God is in all things. God is in the atom and the infinite number of atoms. God is in the nothingness and the allness of space. God is everywhere. There is nowhere where God is not. We cannot say that God is not, that is, God is not in the bad things. We cannot say that because there are no bad things as far as God is concerned. And that God is only in the good things because there is only that which is. All things are an is. It's only when our mental attitudes start making it into a picture for ourselves that we make it good or bad. Of itself, it has no goodness and it has no badness. If I take, as I said the other day, you have your hand here, and I take an axe and I chop down here and miss my hand, you say, "Oh, you almost hit your hand." And if I take the axe and chop down, cut my fingers off, you say, "Oh, that hurts. That's terrible. Don't do that. That's terrible." And you're judging it. The axe cut the fingers off. The axe was not a bad axe because it cut the fingers off. My fingers were not stupid for lying there and being cut off. It's just an is. It's just an is. Now, just to play with that for a second, in Carillion photography, which is done in scientific circles and done at universities, they take pictures of leaves, and then they cut off the leaves and remove the leaves, and they take pictures again, and the energy body of the removed leaves are still there. The reality is still there. The essence is still there. It has not been disturbed. Just the image is disturbed. Just like in our bodies, when we decay and we die or something like that, our bodies decay, and the essence, the image goes away. The essence of our bodies is still there, untouched, as it always will be untouched. If God is in everything, as everything, then theoretically and factually, we should be saying that we are God. And so if you say, I am God, you are not blaspheming God. You are saying, in fact, that God is everywhere, and you are that where God is. Okay, now. Now, this is the reason people don't like to do it. It has nothing to do with blaspheming God, nothing to do with in opposition to the church or religion or anything. It's because if I say, son, you're my boy, and I have taught you how to live your life well, I expect you to live your life well. I'm your father. And so he goes out into the world, and he makes some mistakes. And he says, my dad would never do that. My dad wouldn't do that. You know, and he wouldn't do that. He knows he's making a mistake. He knows that he is all that his father is and more. But he is all that his father is. And he will not make a mistake because he has the responsibility within him to be all that he can be. And we do not want that responsibility. That's why we say that when we have a cold, oh, the cold's going around. Somebody had a cold and they gave it to me, you know. And then it touched the doorknob and then I touched it and then I got a cold, you know. She gave me a cold. Or you give me a headache. Or you make me happy. Ooh, that's a good one, isn't it? You make me happy. If anyone can make you happy or can make you sick, then you are not being the master. You are putting outside of yourself the responsibility you should have with inside of yourself. And the responsibility you have with inside of yourself is being non-judgmental, as we pointed out here in these several points here, one-pointed, untouched, non-possessional, and non-judgmental. We are not possessed by anything. We are the allness of the universe. These are kind of big terms we're throwing around here, but we are responsible for what our world is. If your child goes next door to visit the neighbors, you say to your child, have a good time. And you don't say, make me proud of you, but you say, have a good time. And so the child goes to the neighbors and acts at the neighbors better than he does at home. You know, usually that's the case. He's a better child acting with the neighbors than he is at home because he has to stand up for his own responsibility. He has to stand up for his own responsibility. Now, you see, we have an experience right at this moment that's taking place, and we are allowing that experience to cause in us just exactly what it is intended to do. We have asked this young man to come in here and be a distraction to you, to take you away from the thought that you are the master of yourself. And he's doing a good job. Thank you. But now, he is distracting you from paying attention here. You are working with your divinity. And in working with your divinity, you allow yourself to be distracted from the fact that you are wonderful by all the things that go on in your world, by all of the attitudes that go on in your world, by all of the little things that take place in your world. If you were standing there with who you ever might call a master, and you were worshipfully standing there, and he is sharing with you some of the great things of his heart and his mind, would you allow anything to distract you? If you are a mother, and you have a child, and that child is hanging onto a rope, and you have a scratch, you have an itch, and you have to scratch this, it drives you crazy, you know? But if you let go of that rope, your kid's going to go down into the canyon and die. And if you hang on to that rope, perhaps you'll get him up. At least you got a chance. At least he's not down there. Would you scratch yourself of an itch if you were doing such a thing as holding your child on that rope? You'd say to me, no, you wouldn't. But now, what if somebody came along and tickled you? Would you lose control? A tickle is a self-motivated experience. It has nothing to do with touching your tickle bone or anything else like that. You have trained yourself to be ticklish because you are untouchable, all of you. You are untouchable when your goal is on your child on the end of that rope. Nothing comes into your attention except the possibility of helping in some way to get him out. You call, hey, come on, somebody, give me a hand here. You don't look and see if there's anybody. Hey, anybody, help, 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 give me a hand here. And you will not let your distraction go for a minute. But you do that. We do that. We have allowed ourselves to do it. My sister is talking so loud I can't study. Listen, if you were talking to your boyfriend on the telephone and you were mad, passionately say, oh, you're so what? You wouldn't hear anything else in the room. A father is sitting there watching a game on television and the kids are running through the house and tearing up the house and just having a good old time, and he's watching that TV. And Mama comes in later and she says, dear, what happened to the house here? He says, oh, what do you mean? Well, look at it. I don't know. I was watching TV. He was watching a show, a sporting game, so intensely, that he didn't even know anything was going on around him that was messing up the place. Now, is this true or false? It's true. If that man, who, so to speak, has no more brains in his head than that, can allow that to happen, how often do we let it happen? Do we have the ability to be one-pointed in everything we do? Do we have the ability to say to ourselves, I am whole and perfect, and believe it? And a little pain comes along, I'm whole and perfect. You will not acknowledge that pain. You will not give it power. I'm whole and perfect. All is in divine order right now. Regardless of the appearances that come into our life that say to us that we got a problem, all is in divine order right now. You see, when we instruct the divine in us to respond in a positive way, it responds. When we say to the divine in us, I give up. There's nothing more I can do. I don't know. I have my fill up to here with it. I'd rather jump off the edge of the world. Where is the edge of the world? You know, you want to stop. And you see, you give up. You say to yourself, you have no more strength to carry through. Well, now that's putting a cause in motion, and of course, you get a response. What is it you would like in your life? What anything would you like in your life? Can you be one-pointed on it? Can you be so one-pointed on it that you do it? Rhonda was telling me about her son's friend. And this friend is a great guy, but he is a jerk, a total, absolute idiot jerk in every way. But a nice kid, you know. But when he zeroes in on a project, any project, he zeroes in so one-pointedly, so non-judgmentally, he doesn't judge the project, so unpossessed, he doesn't own it, he's just zeroing in on it. And the project in all of its relevance reveals itself to him so that he understands completely what it's all about. And here the project is something that has boggled the minds of greater thinkers than he, and he's only a teenager. How can he do that? He is being one-pointed. He is being non-possessed. He is being non-judgmental. You see, he's living these principles. Now, how old is he? 14. Now, can we do that? You bet we can. Why do you think Mozart was able to write what he did? You know, Mozart was an absolute idiot. He was an absolute, absolute idiot. He did what nobody else could do. He went to a piece of paper, he listened to a musical piece in his head, and he wrote down every single note that he heard, letter perfect, with no erasures. He never erased anything, with no erasures, and he wrote down every musical point that came to his mind, and they were perfect. And to this day, his music stands as a monument of excellence. He was one-pointed. He was so self-directed. He didn't let anything distract him from what he was doing. His wife may have come into the room, well, let's start earlier, when he was a youngster. He was writing music at 3 and 5 and 6 years of age, and 10 years of age, he was composing music. And do you think that his sister coming into the room bothered him? His sister says, well, hey, come on, let's do this, let's do this here. And he just kept writing down his music. He was connected one-on-one with his thought of the music, and he put that down on paper perfectly. Perfectly. Now, here this kid had no training in being absolute, no training in being one-pointed, no training in having no judgment, no training in learning to not be disturbed by his sister bothering him, no training in that at all. And what did he do? What did he do? He was a supermaster. Now, if you told him at the time he's a supermaster, he'd say, ah, that's what, you know, just do his thing. When he was writing his music, he was great. When he was not writing his music, he was a perfectly normal jerk, you know, a perfectly normal kid doing stupid things, you know. Just because he was a magical man at listening to the music within him and being able to transcribe it and write it before him, didn't make him into not a normal boy. You understand? He was a normal boy. And he was a normal husband, and he was a normal, and not a father, he didn't have any kids, but he was a normal being. You understand? We have the ability to do all these things. We can do them when we learn to be one-pointed, when we learn to be untouched, non-possessed, and non-judgmental. And what happens when we do that? Then we are unconditionally loving. We are unconditionally loved, and we forget the past, and we live in the present. We live in this instant now, and as we live in this instant now, what takes place in our life? What takes place in our life is that we are beautiful beings. We are fulfilled beings. We are lovely beings. Now, some of you profess backgrounds of Hinduism, of Buddhism, of Christianity, of Indian culture. Some of you profess backgrounds of Islamic and every other religious and philosophical culture that you can imagine. Now, you think, I am, let's say, an Islam. Okay, if you're an Islam, why is it that you don't know the Quran from cover to cover without reading it? If you're a Christian, why is it you don't know the New Testament or the whole Bible without reading it? If you are a Hindu or a Buddhist, why is it you don't know the Bhagavad Gita and all the other books cover to cover without reading it? Now, do you think that Buddha, the 27th Buddha that we are familiar with, do you think that when he came along, he studied the ancient scripts? Do you think that he studied the books of the past? He didn't give a hoot and holler in hell about them. He didn't. He went to the Bo tree, and he had his illumination, remember? And in his illumination, he found Nirvana. But he also found that he could be master of himself and live in peace. And so he lived in peace. And he taught nothing but peace. He taught nothing but living in peace. Now, some of his followers, they say he had inner full path and the outer full path and all these other things, but he did not. He did not teach those things. Those things are things that were added unto him. The teachings that we come up with that Jesus is supposed to have given us, he didn't give us. Paul, who was supposed to be a good person telling us all about Jesus, Paul never knew Jesus. He never knew him. He met him on the road to Damascus in his upper limit of consciousness, but he never knew him. He never had any idea what Jesus was like. And Jesus came to him and said, Paul, or Saul, why are you prosecuting me? Yeah. Why do you hate me? And until he came to the conclusion of why, he was blinded. And so then he went on and taught what he thought Jesus taught. And all of the other religions of the world, are similar to this. The followers rewrite the religion. The Islamic teachings, Mohammedism, is one of the most beautiful teachings in the world. But the followers have made it into a militaristic philosophy that made it very difficult for the people to follow without being very hateful. And go ahead and say, ha ha ha. Well, the Christians did the same thing. What do you think happened at the Crusades? The Crusades, the soldier, the people were marching down the coast of Europe, and anyone who would not admit to being a Christian, they killed them by the thousands and thousands. The plague was not even as bad as the killings that were done in the name of Christianity. And it goes on even today. Even today. And why do we have these things? For one reason. We're worshiping an outer God. And so long as we worship an outer God, we will have conflict among nations and among men and among circumstances. But the moment we start having the divine within us be what we worship, as long as we live harmoniously with what the divine within us would have us be and have us do, we will find that everything will work out in perfect harmony. The divine in you wants your best. The divine in you wants you to live the most beautiful, fulfilled, happy life that is possible to live. The divine in you does not want anything from anybody else. It doesn't need it. The divine in you wants to teach you what you already know. If you have the right attitude of your mind, you can live without food, without water, without air, and you can exist very happily and very wonderfully if you choose to. But we say that's stupid. The body needs it. No, the body is not designed to process these materials. The body, what would you say, changed to accommodate these materials after its creation, but it was not designed in the ideal archetypal form to do this. Our original purity and integrity does not need that. We need that because we want to first interrelate as human beings. We want to respond to each other as human beings. If you and I were to live our life as divine beings, as beautiful beings, we would see everybody else exactly like we are, and they are. We would see everybody whole and perfect. We would see everybody else happy, everybody else filled with all the abundance, independently wealthy. We would see everyone living harmoniously with one another. We would see, no, they don't have to be exactly alike, but we would see them living in this universal peace. And as they live in this universal peace, we would see really peace on earth. And we would really see what all great teachers have sought to teach to the world, that they are the masters of themselves. And it's up to them to live as the masters of themselves and take charge of their world, take charge of their being, take charge of whatever things are important to them. Now, for 3 days we've been sharing here and having a wonderful time, and actually 4 days, but for 3 days we've been sharing here, and we have this wonderful group of people here who have allowed us to use their temple, and we're appreciative of that. However, every moment that any of the people who work here, or who are studying here, or who are participating in the program here in any way, every time they had an opportunity to come in and sit with us, they would come in and sit with us. Now, why would they come in and sit with us when we represent perhaps a different cultural milieu than who they are? We have a different cultural attitude, a different cultural condition than what they're familiar with. Why would they come in here? They come in here because what we are teaching now, what we are sharing right now among ourselves, is the universal principle of all life. The universal principle that all is one. There is only one. There is only one universal creator, as far as I'm concerned. Only one universal creator that created the entire universe and the allness, and that universal creator is in everybody, in everything. And each of us choose to express it in our unique and beautiful way. And sometimes we express it in a negative way, but most of the time we express it in a positive way. Now I would like to be very definite on this next point. In the United States, there are thousands and thousands of hospitals. And in these thousands of hospitals are hundreds of thousands of people. And together, all the people in the hospitals, this is not a factual number, but it's an approximation, there are approximately 0.1% of the population of the United States in the hospital at one time, okay? 0.1% of the total millions of people in the United States who are in the hospital at any one time. In any city, in Las Vegas here, how many hospitals do you have? Do you have as many hospitals as you have private homes? No. It's a silly thing to say, isn't it? Your hospitals are minimal. And in the hospital, do you have as many people as you pack into a square block of a city, you know, or maybe two square blocks? No. You know, you have a lot of people, but not that many. You see, we have the idea that the world is sick, and the world is not sick. The majority, the super majority, over 90%, 99.1% of the people of the world are not sick. And yet, we love to talk about sickness. And now let's take another point. How many people in the world are criminals? How many people in the world are in prison? How many people in the world are incarcerated in some way or other? Again, but a tiny fraction. Why is it our newspapers, magazines, and television, our movies, why is it they give such a high percentage of their coverage to the negative activities of the world? And isn't it wonderful that the world doesn't get worse because of what they're doing? Thank God. You know? Isn't it wonderful? Now, in the United States, I should double check. I had it in my fingertips the other day. In the United States, there are approximately 15% of all the children in the United States who are going to school who are taught privately, who are taught by their parents. By private school, but by their parents at home, home taught. And of these children who are home taught, the majority of them, about 80%, are in the highest percentile class of the graduates from the high schools. 80%. And they're in the highest percentile because they get the best and the most beautiful direction from their parents, rather than from being just a number in a classroom, you know? And they do well. And they excel. And the mother is not a teacher. The mother loves her child. And she wants the child to read the book, to study the book, to follow what the book says, and to fill in the answers and do the things they're supposed to do. And the children are excellent. The children are excellent because they are given love and attention. Now, we give all that attention to the criminal element of the world, and we put it on our movies and television and radio and newspapers, and we espouse it in such terrible ways. You'd think that the country was just going to hell in the basket, you know? And it's not. We have one of the most wonderful worlds in the world, the only world we know. filled with beautiful people who love one another, who enjoy one another, who creates, why do you go to war?
Because my country needs me.
Bullshit. Your country doesn't need you. The legislators need you. They want to build up the economic problems of the world and solve them through war. They want to make jobs through building weapons and things like that. They want to make jobs through doing things to other nations and sending the men away to war. And it's silly, just a silly thing. To kill off the young, beautiful people who are the true blood of our world by sending them to war. How sad. No. Why do we do this? Why do we do this? We can put the cause in motion that when our government feels that they want to have more countries to own, in other words, they want to reach over and grab their neighbor, that there is a rule among all nations on the earth. If one government wants to reach over and grab the other government, you take the two heads of state and put them together naked in a room. You give them a deck of cards or whatever and have them sit in that room until they come to a decision of how they're going to handle it. And you see, when you're naked, you don't have your symbols of importance on. You don't have your leadership role and all that stuff. So you're just natural there. And pretty soon they say, this isn't cool. Now, look, I've got all this in my country, and you've got all this in your country, and we could benefit each other by merging. So why don't we have the United States of Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia, or something like that, you know. Why not do that? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Now, you see, if we did that, if the United Nations made that as a rule, no country could have any weapons. They could not fight, or they could not go after each other. There would be no weapons on earth. Then how would a country work with each other? By the mind. By the leaders getting together. By the leaders getting together. Now, here in Las Vegas, you have a lot of strange people. They speak Spanish. They have come here from Mexico, and they want to make a nice living, and they want to have a nice place to live. And it's good. It's good. But it's silly. They left their country because their country did not provide them with the opportunity to have a good living, to have enough money to live comfortably and harmoniously. And so they run away to America right next door because it looks like a big, rich country and they can earn a good living and send money home to their family and live more comfortably than they have ever before. And that's beautiful. Now, we Americans could go down and annex Mexico, and it'd be like in Germany, you know, East Germany, West Germany, when East Germany or West Germany took over East Germany, they had a lot of problems because it was a third world country. But in time, East Germany is polishing itself up beautifully. Now, if we took over Mexico, we would be destroying a cultural ethic. If we instead were to begin to say, just by ourselves, now there's peace on earth, if we were to begin to say, Mexico has the finest governing body in the world. The Mexican governing body is interested only in the people. What is for the highest and the best of the people? The Mexican government is bringing into the Mexican culture fine industries and fine companies and fine roads and fine schools and fine hospitals and fine everything. If we, in this small group here, were to make statements like that and believe them and find them enjoyable to make, we would establish the beginning of a wonderful revolution in Mexico wherein the government is of the people, by the people, for the people, where the government is benefiting the people, where Mexico becomes one of the major forces in the world as far as economics goes, and all the people have an opportunity to live in abundance as they do here in the United States if they wish. And we still have street people who walk around begging money from people because they don't want to work. You say, well, they can't work. They can. We know they can. But that's their work, to beg. And we have created them doing it, and they're enjoying it. I'm not saying they're good. I'm not saying they're bad. I'm saying that's what they choose. Some people want to be a musician, and some people want to be a contractor, and some people want to be a father. And, you know, these are all just things we want to be, and it's okay. But I say, if we were to think for Mexico, that it is a grand and glorious country, filled with people interested in their own nation, building their nation up so that it has an equal wage earning capacity like the United States does, what would happen to Mexico? What would happen to Canada if we did that same thing? You know, Canada is not as an abundant country as we think it is. It's good, but it's not abundant because it's fighting against itself. It has the French and it has the English, Canadians fighting against each other. It has the people on the western part of the country thinking they're better than the people on the eastern part of the country, and the people on the eastern part thinking they're better than the people. It's their own nation. Why don't they unite together and say, let's have this, the greatest United States of Canada, you know, that ever existed. We're working together as one people. So I say to you, in your mind, in your heart, you can be a blessing to the world by seeing it done now. And you can also be a blessing to yourself by seeing yourself aware, alert, and experiencing all that divinity has within you. Because I'm sorry to tell you this, but this is my fact. This is my fact. I see you whole and perfect. Good? Mm-hmm. I see you independently wealthy. Yep. Sweetheart? Yeah? I see you independently wealthy. Is that good? You bet. I see you healthy and filled with every great joy of your heart right now. Is that good? That's the way I see you. I'm sorry. And I see you illumined in such a beautiful way that when you write the story of your life, it'll be a great candle of glory and wisdom to the rest of the world. Can you see that? Mm-hmm. And I see you as a balancer. I see you at peace and balance in your life. And that every person who enters your world is at peace and balance. You feel the goosebumps in your arms now? You bet you do. And you, I see you totally harmonious with yourself. And the only person that matters in your life is yourself. And because you are so beautiful in yourself, all your world is a joy to be in. And you, Miss Mary Tuffet, you, I see you as an illuminating light also. And I see you in the work that you choose for yourself, which may not be what you're doing right now. But I see you in the work that you choose for yourself, that wherever you go, everybody is going to feel as though they have been in the presence of nobility, of divinity, of magic, because that's who you are. And you, Miss Fantastic, my sidekick, you, I see as a person who is living fully revealed now, master of your body, master of your mind, master of your affairs, so that you are a living example to all in your world of who you are. And it doesn't matter, because you are it. You're like the prodigal son. He came home, remember? And his father didn't say, oh, that damn kid's home again. You know? The father said, gather together the finest clothing, go out and give him a bath and put good clothing on him before he enters the house, and take the fatted calf and make a great party where my son is home. He was lost and now he's found. He's home. And never once did the father ask where the son had been and what he had done. But he recalled him home. And this is what you will help share with the world, that the prodigal is home, and that all is forgotten, all is forgiven, and the world is at peace. And you, lovely precious, I see you so peaceful and content in yourself that whatever had been your life before this moment, which was a lot of good stuff, but whatever was your life before this moment is now absolutely, totally, fully forgotten. And you live in the present moment, and you're enjoying the present moment, and you are expressing something that you had never dreamed you would express before. But you watch. It will not be something that will be harmful to you. It will be something that will be opening your heart to making you feel your life is fulfilled, you know? And Mr. Ken, you think you're so tough. You think you're such a an old toughy, and you aren't. You're an old teddy bear like me, you know. And you love everybody, and you love everything, and you're full of beautiful stories and beautiful tales. And I would be very delighted to read those tales, if you ever chose to write them down, of the ones your father told you long ago, and the ones that you saw in your childhood and in your growing up years, because you have a gift to give to the world, and that gift is a gift of happiness and joy and the feeling of great enthusiasm. And you know it. You know it. And so I just say, I see you letting go of all the limitations and bringing forth all the glory that you are. Now that got you all, didn't it? Woo! We forgot Barbara Rich here. And madame, you have just entered a new phase of your life. And that new phase of your life is a phase where you're not doing anything for anybody. You're just unconditionally loving everybody. And everybody who comes into your world is a perfect expression of who you are. It's just like the girl whose father flew her from Hawaii every day to take a course from you in learning how to get her high school education. Now, why did they fly her to you, and why did she succeed so beautifully? Why? Because of one thing. Because your heart is so big and so open. Because you are such a generous, fantastic being, that you've wrapped the world in your love. And the world is saying, more, more, more. And you do it so well. And you are a very great success at it. Obviously, to look at what you're doing, you're a very great success at it. But that's nothing compared to what is before you in the next year or so. You watch and see. Magic. Okay, now you've all had my inner feeling of joy for you. It's not a reading. I don't give readings. But I'm just looking at your hearts. And I'm seeing in your hearts the beauty, the goodness, the fabulous qualities that are there. And I am just honored and privileged to be in your presence. And thank you for being here. I love you.